Well, I am very excited to make you talk about another American company today. Robinhood. Robinhood just did their biggest ever acquisition, Trade PMR, $300 million acquisition. We talked previously about how Stripe just did their biggest ever acquisition. We've got all these companies placing big bets about what the future of their company looks like. So I'm excited to unpack this one. But are you excited about this one?
Yeah, I guess I have questions, right? So let's just recap. So the $300 million acquisition of Trade PMR is their biggest. And there's a lot of reasons why it could make sense. So Trade PMR, as I understand it, is a technology platform that helps RIAs manage their clients, share data with their clients, and kind of helps them custody a lot of their assets and, you know, kind of really deal with that wealth advisor space. Whereas Robinhood canonically was it's my trading app, but now they're getting into helping me manage savings and 401ks and credit cards, but it's direct to consumer. So this obviously gives them a new channel, potentially TAM expansion. So there's a lot of reasons why you might want them to go the indirect route through RIAs, but educate me on the market and the strategic rationale for this, because, you know, obviously I've bumped into a few wealth advisors, but I've never had one. So I'd like to understand that market.
Yeah, so I think this is a fascinating acquisition and a very interesting story, and it's going to force a lot of people to think about a market they haven't thought about and realize it's a very interesting market that is up for grabs in a way that was just not true previously. So that's all super abstract, so let's make that a little bit more concrete. So what is Robinhood today? Robinhood is, to be blunt, a casino for retail traders. They've got $150 billion in assets under management. They've got 25 million customers. Their average account balance is $6,000. Their average ARPU is like $100, about that much, right? So these are basically 25 million people who don't have a lot of money, who are doing a lot of trades, which drives revenue for Robinhood, and they make like $100 or so off of each of them. So they're doing like $2.5 billion in revenue. That's been a good business. I think it shocked people the extent to which it is a big business. You know, they're worth tens of billions of dollars in the public markets. But when you dive into wealth world, that is a small sliver of the actual opportunity, because wealth world is skewed. So those individuals, the assets they hold, it's not that many, right? So Robinhood has like $150 billion assets under management. Maybe the total TAM for that category is like a trillion, or maybe not even that much. So they're like pretty well penetrated into that core audience that they kind of helped pioneer a business model around to some extent on free trades. You know, other people have served in different ways historically. But there's a bigger market, and it's a lot bigger market. There's the $15 trillion in AUM RIA market. So what does that even mean? Well, wealthy people usually use an RIA or a wealth advisor to help them manage their assets. Those people usually have 3 million plus in investable assets. And that is where the vast majority of AUM sits. And if you're Robinhood and you want to build a massive business, you're not content to just hang out down here running the casino. You probably want to operate a robo-advisor, which they'll probably launch at some point in time, but that's separate from this story, and that moves you into mass affluent. And you also want to launch a custody business with probably tech on top of it that will serve the RIA channel. Now, this is a completely different channel, right? We're talking about you're not going to have a first-party relationship with your customers, and you're not going to monetize through like letting them day trade. You're going to be a custodian layer that is going to serve RIAs who themselves serve clients. Those people also have a fiduciary obligation to like do the right things for their clients, which is just kind of anathema to how Robinhood, they have like a best efforts execution. So they do have some regulatory requirements about how they have to meet treats, but it's a very different client infrastructure base, all of that. But it is a big, huge market. And I think people are going to wake up to the extent that this is market. I think it's going to be super hard for Robinhood to execute against. I think this trade makes a lot of sense. $300 million acquisition to buy. So Trade PMR has like $40 billion in assets under management, and I forget how many RIAs are on the M platform. It's basically an option for them to spend a few years learning about what it would look like to really get into the RIA market. Now, they do have a huge strategic advantage. So they're founder-led. They've got Vlad. He's super aggressive. They also have great product and engineering talent. And three, they've built their own custodian. And that's huge because they're one of the first new custodians. So they have the most foundational piece of infrastructure there, which is why they're like, we should explore this. But there is a lot in the middle that they're going to have to learn. So this is not like, oh, they bought it, like, next year Robinhood's doing, you know, RIA software. This is like Robinhood spends 3 years learning, and if they learn and execute well, they have a chance of moving into this bigger market. And that's super interesting.
So I can see this on the M&A deck and the spreadsheet. Like, it completely makes sense on the spreadsheet. Rather than using like State Street or BNY to be my custodian if I'm PMR, well, part of the same business, I'm going to be doing that at cost. So Trade PMR is got some cost takeout or efficiencies, as the bankers love to call it. So that makes sense. And then the other thing is, like, there's all of this TAM over here that I don't have, and I got to figure out how am I going to go get that TAM, and because I'm playing in this bottom end of the market, and I might have saturated it. And there's a lot of other things they've done to try and go up market. Like you said, there's the potential they could do things in the future, but they acquired another company called X1 Card. There's Robinhood Gold, the subscriptions product, and then there's the Gold Card that comes with that, which has an insane cashback offer. I think it's around like, what, 2%, something like that. And then the Roth IRA transfers, they're offering a lot. If you transfer your 401ks, like, the offer to move money to them to grow AUM is the best in the market. Like, they have insane pricing. So they really are aggressively trying to expand away from that segment that, as you say, is the core of their business, but it's not the only business they can be in the future. There was something in the press that the founder of Trade PMR said, which is they like this deal because for the next 2 years or so, as you say it, but from their perspective in perpetuity, they're going to be left to run that business. So I wonder if it's almost like, well, does this just become a conglomerate where there's this like whole other subsidiary business over here that never gets a Robinhood logo in it? Or like X1 Card, will it become the Robinhood Gold Card in time, and you start to see that brand try and move? And I don't know if that works for RIAs or that segment.
And this is what we've talked about in other episodes, which is there's a rebundling underway, and it's still not clear who's going to be able to rebundle what. I think it's a pretty big stretch for Robinhood to be able to become an RIA platform. But if you look at the big banks, if you look at Wells Fargo, they have, you know, a custody business, and they have a credit card business, and they do home loans. So universal banks already are these kind of bundles. Robinhood's coming along, and they're going to try and bundle in some other stuff. I think stuff like the X1 card, you know, maybe a robo, like, that's closer to their core audience today. Seems like more of a thing they could execute against. But this is the biggest part of the market, and they do have the custodian itself already ready. So I could see why they would want to go after this. I think maybe another lens, too, to break down is just, like, who are the biggest winners and losers in this scenario? So I think the biggest loser in this scenario is Wells Fargo and First Clearing. So they're a bunch of legacy custodians. They own 80 or 90% of the market across like three or four of them. First Clearing, owned by Wells Fargo, is one of them. And those custody layers, like, RIAs like using them because, like, oh, you're safe, it's Wells, right? You're safe, it's Morgan Stanley, et cetera. But the tech layers that get built on top of that, it's just crap because it's in part so hard to integrate with this core-like system of record. And so that is going to have to change. And so Trade PMR said, look, nothing's changing. Everything's staying with First Clearing and Wells. That's $40 billion assets. That $40 billion of assets is eventually going to move off of Wells and onto Robinhood's custodian. And other assets are going to start to migrate, I think, out of those big custodians. So I think the big losers, and this is not an overnight story. This is maybe a 10-year trend of these folks finally starting to feel some pressure. So I think those are the big losers. I think the big winner is Altruist. And like, disclosure, I'm an investor in Altruist. I also technically own a small position in Robinhood, so none of this is investing advice. But what is Altruist? Altruist has been building this platform. They are also a custodian, and they are laser focused on this market from day one. The founder, Jason, he started an RIA, scaled it to like $1.8 billion in assets. Then he started a tech-enabled RIA, Formula Folios, scaled that to like $3.8 billion in assets. And he's an engineer by training, I should mention as well. And now he started Altruist, which is a tech platform for RIAs that also owns the custodian. So here's a unicorn founder who really understands this market, has been building it for 8 years. And I think most investors like just don't know that this company exists. And they didn't realize the extent to which there was a big market up for grabs here. And what Robinhood's acquisition of Trade PMR does is says, hey, there's a market here worth going after. And now a bunch of people are going to start to think about, oh, well, then who's positioned to win it? Is it Robinhood? Maybe. Founder, CEO, great product tech team, already have a custodian. But oh my God, look at this other company. And actually, they're scaling AUM very quickly, and they're laser focused on this market. So I actually think that's probably the biggest winner, and a lot of people aren't going to talk about. By the way, Jason Wenk has a great breakdown, that's the CEO of Altruist, of why, like what to think about when you reflect on the Robinhood acquisition of Trade PMR. And he's like, look, they're an amazing, Robinhood's an amazing company with amazing execution. It's going to be hard for them, but like I wouldn't count them out.
With the path to integration was going to be my question, which is, you know, the X1 card was a company they acquired, I think, for about $90 million. But the reality is that X1 card is like, it looks and feels like a Robinhood product as Robinhood Gold, but it's a separate app. It's a separate download. It's a separate KYC. Like, it's just kind of sitting there with a different logo on it. And how much is this going to be that? Because what you're doing there is you're recreating the mistakes of the acquisitions of banks in the past, right? What you go scratch under the hood of Chase and Wells and all of those organizations, and what you'll see is this family tree of lots of other acquisitions over the past 100 years or so. And all of these previous acquisitions never really got integrated very well. They all came with their own systems, their own processes, their own customers, their own offices, their own HQs, like, and cultures that don't really fit. So while the logo is the same, the product is different and it's not integrated. And to your point about like the tech is crap, the incumbents and the RIAs hate it. The tech might be really good in something, but if where we're going is towards rebundling and you have the capacity to rebundle things, you know, how much does it matter that you can actually have some control over destiny of that? So I wonder about that rebundling, but talk to me about that, and also talk to me about, you know, kind of what else we need to think about with this transaction.
I think that's a great point. Like, can today's company, you know, Robinhood is, I think, now in its second decade. So they're not a super young company, and it's not easy to integrate these things. Even if you have great tech teams and the stacks are more modern. So that is going to be an open question, is the extent to which Robinhood can rebundle and what they can rebundle. To your point, even X1 today, you know, it's still a lot of work. Maybe I'll read a little bit of Jason's post about how he thinks the acquisition will go, because I think that'll give people a good sense. And I generally agree with this. So this is Jason, founder CEO of Altruist. He says, are you curious what the Trade PMR and Robinhood acquisition looks like? LinkedIn post, read on. First, he's like, congrats to the team. Rob Baldwin, they've been building this for 25 years. And congrats to Vlad and the crew at Robinhood. This is a hard business. I want them, you know, wishing the best. But here's what it's going to look like. So first, they will get regulatory approval and officially close the transaction. Probably happens next year. I suspect April. After that, they will start learning from Trade PMR. They'll learn all the nuances of servicing RIAs, of which there are many. 50-plus account types, need to add mutual funds, fixed income, alts, insurance products, need to integrate with 50-plus fintech vendors advisors rely on, need to build an entirely new advisory platform, need to do everything both digital and with paper. Like, you will have to support paper flows, need to have humans available via phone with deep understanding of RIA business model. All of this will turn into a product roadmap that will require 2 to 3 years of development. And so that's where they are in this journey. It's going to be a big, long, hard journey with a big product build, but a huge prize at the end if you can execute it. But it's not an easy thing to execute against.
Who else is out there in the market that could execute this? So there's Altruist, there's Robinhood, but who else? Who else is out there?
And so Altruist is kind of my top of list, and then, you know, maybe there are some other people who get started, but it's pretty hard to build these businesses. And so I think that's why I think the biggest losers are the legacy custodians, because I think the writing is going to be on the wall between it's Robinhood or Altruist. Maybe there's someone else coming in. I think the biggest unknown is the extent to which Robinhood can execute against this opportunity and under what timeline. I certainly wouldn't count them out, but I wouldn't say this is a walk in the park. And so that's why it's going to be interesting to watch.
Being a custodian is like non-trivial. It's kind of the metaphor, the analogous to getting a de novo charter in the broader banking space at the federal level. Like, this is a high bar, and that anybody who gets through that bar then has to build a business. It's like, okay, well done, you got a charter, now go build a business out of it. And that's a high bar. And to your point, then you're dealing with a world of like, are you just going to go after the digitally savvy RIAs? Because there's still a lot of paper in the world and you got to figure out what you're going to do with that. But talk to me about Vlad as a founder and this acquisition and M&A route and zooming out to Robinhood. Are they looking at M&A for growth? Do you think that's going to be how they can scale? And what are your views on M&A for growth versus others? Because I look at Stripe and I'd say when they've done M&A, typically the thing that they bought gets subsumed and just looks like a Stripe product and feels very different on the execution side. Does Robinhood have a shot at doing that? And who else might be acquisitive in the broader fintech space and what could they learn from this?
Yeah, and I don't know. I think Robinhood has shown, one, that they're aggressive at pursuing new products, which is very interesting. The card, Robinhood Gold, you know, they'll launch some other stuff, I think, in the coming year or so. But this is kind of a new degree of difficulty that they're exploring. So we'll see. But it's going to be a very interesting tenure. And to your point, you know, maybe to connect this to something the audience is a little more familiar with, a lot of people understand it's hard to get a bank charter. I think people just haven't been paying attention to the custodian market. It's like even more removed.
It's a sleepy backwater. We everybody's launched a debit card in fintech, or everybody's been close to it, or everybody's followed the news on this big program's blown up. There's so many more banks. There's so many more fintech companies. There's just a lot of them coming out of the fintech boom. But there weren't many people sort of starting de novo banks. And so that's a helpful metaphor to kind of understand it. And then to the second point, there just aren't a lot of people that have worked in the weeds on that. So the concentration of talent that could actually go build this company is few and far between. And if they do exist, yeah, they probably worked.
There are very few people, because very few people have built these. Wealthfront has done this. Robinhood has done this. I'm probably forgetting someone else, but very few people have actually worked to do this. So it's just not out there in the ecosystem at a talent level about how you would even do it.
I think there's something interesting about, like, while there are, you know, Wealthfront and others, some meaningfully scaled robo-advisors, if I was to cast the clock back 10 years ago, and a lot of folks thought that robo would eventually displace wealth management and that would become the default and we would all be using digital robo instead of RIAs, but it seems to me like that's not gone away. Is there a disruption possibility for the channel side, for the RIAs themselves, especially as, you know, there's a generational wealth transfer underway to Gen Y and Gen Z coming? I don't know how many $1 trillion of wealth might be about to transfer, but the RIAs are worried about, like, well, if my client dies, is this just going to all end up going somewhere else, and where's it going to go? So what are your thoughts on that wealth transfer space?
So first of all, wealth world is big enough. You can have winners at each level. So Robinhood's already, you know, multi $10 billion company. The robo advisors for the mass affluent can still be big companies, even if all they do is serve the mass affluent folks with, you know, 50 to 800K of investable assets. RIA is the place that hasn't been touched as much. And I think the main takeaway I want for people, if you hear like the words custodian, instead of like your eyes glazing over and moving on, be like, oh, there's something interesting going on here that I should pay attention to the next few years. And so I think people can figure out and carve these niches. And one of the open questions is the extent to which parts of these get pulled into each other. I think my perspective is not that RIAs will go away. I think RIAs will become more like robos in that they will incorporate more automation. I think their pricing, though, will be the same, close to 1% of assets under management. But for that pricing, clients will get more value, because more things will start to get bundled into that. And so this is kind of a postulation I put forth, that RIAs have a really good business model, right? It's a fixed fee on assets under management. Robinhood's revenue right now, very volatile, depending on how active traders are. Asset managers or RIAs, they just clip that fee continuously. Now, markets go up and down, but generally they go up. And so you have this baked-in growth, baked-in stability. That's very high-quality revenue. And it's pretty high margin revenue. And now RIAs, I think, are going to get more into offering other services like tax advice, tax guidance, estate planning that used to be outsourced to third-party professionals. But I think that's going to get more closely integrated because some of the software is making that easier. So that's, I think, about where the world is headed, which hints at why you need to have a regime shift even at the custodial layer, is more people need to be able to integrate with that kind of core system of record to create these frictionless client experiences, where when you go to do your tax prep, it's not like you're pulling all this data out of all these different sources. It just flows through nicely. You know, if we go back to Jason's post, oh, we have to support 50 account types. Of those 50 account types, 40 of them have implications for what shows up on your tax return. How do we get that data from one thing to another? And so that, and then the RIAs are like, and our clients are not happy with our current set of systems, our current digital dashboards, our current reportings. They come to us and they're asking us for all these other services. And $80 trillion is the wealth transfer, is transferring from boomers to millennials and Gen Z and eventually Gen Alpha. And they're going to have different expectations. And so advisors are like, we need to start to figure this out. And so that's why this is kind of a story that I feel like most people aren't paying attention to. But there's going to be a sleepy big business built here. And I think the market is going to wake up to that.
Digital has become the default for multiple generations, all the way up to 42, 43. But even for a lot of the Gen Xers, right? Like, this is, digital has been kind of standard for a little while. And so if you're not meeting people, customers where they are and their expectations where they are, I can imagine it's a real concern for the RIAs to be like, I am going to lose this customer once my customer dies and kind of they transfer that wealth. And so I wonder if the answer, you know, like, will Trade PMR get to continue to be a custodian for everybody else's distribution platform? Or will in time they sort of want to go more vertical? So am I a custodian for everybody that's doing those digital tools and solutions, and I'm going to publish some really nice APIs, and I'm also going to offer it direct. So I'm going to build sort of a customer facing and a rear facing dashboard that's Robinhood branded. And that would be the only way you could work with the office formerly known as Trade PMR, and it's just going to be tightly coupled. Or am I going to say, Robinhood competitors, why don't you use our infrastructure? Because I've seen that second pattern play out time and time again in financial services, right? Like, you look at a giant bank like Chase or Wells Fargo, yes, they go direct to consumer, but they're also holding the funds and managing the payments for some of the largest fintech companies that compete with them and other banks that compete with them. This sort of like dual world is kind of normal. So I wonder which way these guys will go.
And that's why it's the start of a long road for Robinhood. It's 2 to 3 years to decide what the product build out is going to be and then how you bring that build out to market.
Vlad's got an interesting task in front of him. That's
he
for
does.
Sure.
He does. Definitely does. I'm very excited to see what happens with it, for sure.
No, me too, because this is one of those companies that got crushed in the 2022 sort of like fintech bear market. At the moment, it's very much the opposite narrative, the we are so back market. That gives me concerns because, you know, I've seen this movie before through several cycles, and usually something goes wrong inevitably and people don't learn lessons. But I'm hopeful for this, that we're now getting into fintech with a capital F, which is we're getting at the infrastructure, we're getting at the bare metal. And that's another pattern that's repeating, you know, whether it's Move or whether it's Silverflow, you're seeing these brand new acquirers in the payments industry that are all the way down to direct into Visa and MasterCard. You're seeing it with the Gen 3 issuers with Lithic and Highnote and Episode 6. These bare metal like access for developers, where you used to have all of these intermediaries, like if you wanted to do something, those layers are getting stripped away and somebody's gone right down to the metal, but they've done it with modern digital technology. That strips out cost structure, but it also means that the product innovation you can unlock when I'm closer to the metal is significantly higher, because I'm not using somebody else's tech and somebody else's tech and somebody else's tech and compliance rules all the way through. It's mine all the way. And what do you want to do? And here's the API for it.
And this is why when people say like, oh, it's fintech over, like what could be happening? I'm just so glad that you see ambition at all levels. Certainly at the pre-seed and seed companies that I back, some of them are building amazing kind of multi-product solutions from day one. But even when you look at the public markets, you look at someone like Robinhood and you're like, oh, they just launched a new product in a market that's 10 times bigger than their core offering. Where are they going to be another 5 or 7 years? Are they going to be just a fundamentally different company than what they are today? Maybe. And that's when I think about, you know, oh, wow, we're really just getting started. And if that does come true, again, super hard to execute against, who loses? And this is another thing we've talked about. It will be the existing custodians, you know, Wells Fargo and First Clearing, some of the other big wirehouses, et cetera. That is interesting because it's going to start to pull market share away from the incumbents into the startups and new products that are built on top of new bare metal. And that, like, we're just actually getting started. And so when I look at stuff like this, I'm like, man, fintech is so young and so interesting and so much more work to be done.
I think a lot of people that look at fintech and say it's done, it's like, oh, we have neobanks, it's over, because they're thinking about it with their consumer experience, or they've seen what's happened in SMB. But as I look at like what the universal banks do, and you look at all of those revenue pools, there's a whole bunch of those missing. And then you go look at the vendor stack of all of those sub-verticals in financial services, and there's a whole bunch of those missing. And I think if you've not looked at all of the different parts that a universal bank does and all the different parts of that industry, especially as you get towards the capital markets end, the amount of people that have actually worked in capital markets, never mind know how the infrastructure works and the regulation, is vanishingly few. And a lot of them are quite well paid and an incumbent, so they have no real incentive to leave. Or if they do, are they the entrepreneurial sort? Are they going to go build something? Well, that's starting to happen now because the cost of creating companies is a lot greater, and they're seeing those opportunities. You've also got a lot of wedges in with capital markets, with Gen AI and with other things. So the market is not static. The tools you have to build companies change over time.
You asked earlier, what talent understands how to build this? And I told you, well, Jason's kind of a unicorn founder at Altruist. There aren't that many people who could build something like that. But now, let's take the like absolute bear case where Robinhood like falls on its face with this. Altruist doesn't work out for some reason. Like, robos aren't a thing. You still have these people who tried, learned how these systems worked, and they're going to try again. And so even if, which I do not think that, I think one of these groups is going to figure out something pretty interesting, but even if they didn't, the talent is now going to exist to know how to tackle that problem a second time around. And that's something that commentators miss, is that when companies fail, the companies failed, but the people got smarter. And that's why I'm excited, is because there's so many more people who are smarter and are going to try new things, even if the first attempt didn't work out.
Didn't you have a talent chart that you had once of like the amount of people that have worked in fintech, and then the exponential growth in people that have worked in fintech over the past decade or so?
Totally. And it's such a banal point, I think, but it's so true, and it really matters.
Sometimes the things that seem obvious are not obvious. There was this fun period in like 2010 through maybe 2020 where a lot of people from tech discovered that finance is hard. You know, you had like this product management tech growth discipline hitting compliance and financial services and industry specialism, and it just went poof. And probably see that most in 2021, 22, where it's like, oh, things are hard, things went wrong. But what you get out of that is a lot of people that have now got the scars on their back of like having done that before, whether they've exited something, whether it closed down, whether they've landed somewhere else temporarily, but they've got that itch they need to scratch. There's just hundreds of thousands of people that now both are world-class engineers, world-class product people that would get a job in any tech company, but that speak finance. And that was not true 10 years ago. Like, I think one of the things that helped me build some sort of an audience was being the person that could speak both languages 10 years ago. And now there's so many of us that like that's not an issue. It's just I happen to be sitting here on a decade of audience building, so I still have a permission to be in the conversation. But I've been in a room in DC all week where I'm just like, these people understand all of this stuff. They understand compliance, they understand tech, they understand product. This is a very different market, and that gives me fuel, definitely.
Yeah, it's all about the people at the end of the day, and we've got more good people building than ever.
Here, man.
All right, super fun. Good to see you.
Good to see you, my friend.
Cheers.